Well, hello, this is Regina. I guess you guys know that, though. you know, it's funny, my brain's been funny all day, so if I seem funny tonight, it's like this morning when I woke up, my brain didn't. And it's been a little groggy, and I've heard some really strange things come out of my mouth, so whatever. Whatever I say tonight, I say, and that's just that. But I guess what I'll say first is that we do have a song that we're going to play. This song is a variation on Twinkle Twinkle Little Star, and it's both written and performed by Dave Van Dyke, who has been here with us the last couple of Tuesdays, but tonight he has the flu, so he's not here. I also played a song of his at the weekly gathering on Sunday, a song called Free at Last. So this is another one of Dave's songs. And what's the name of the song? It's not Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star.
Little Star.
Little Star. Okay. And it looks like it's played on a toy piano.
Yep.
Okay. So we have a couple of new beings in the room tonight. One is my friend Laura Bedford. Laura has been walking, similar to Peace Pilgrim, for not quite 2.5 years, right? It was like May 2 years ago, so probably 2.25 years. And she's now going to settle here in Pueblo West for a while. We'll see how long. But she's here tonight. And then the other being is a puppy dog named Sheba. And Sheba is a rescue dog. She's rescued from the puppy mill. She was a professional mommy. having litter after litter after litter after litter after litter. And so she's here, and she's not quite sure about these human beings yet. She's real gentle. She kind of hides in the corner. Danielle's petting her right now, and she's just not real sure. Ken and Rebecca adopted her last Friday, so she's really, today is her third full day in the house.
Yes.
Yes, and so she's just not so sure yet, but she's coming around, I think, a little bit, maybe. Yeah, a little bit. So, hello again, and as you all know, we're here for the Gentle Healing Group, and also, as you all know, you guys get to share first, and so when you share, you're going to be sharing on workbook lessons 215 to 221, all of which we'll review except for today. Today begins a whole new section of the course, and we'll be with this new process that was introduced today for quite some time. So today was a whole new beginning with lesson 221. And then in addition to lessons 215 to 221, we read from The Most Direct Means to Eternal Bliss, chapters 4, 5, and 12. Plus, of course, you can always just share on your own healing process and how you're experiencing that. So who would like to get us started today with sharing? All right, Nancy.
Hi. Thank you. I don't know where to start. I talked to Stephen a little earlier, and I couldn't hold it together when I was talking to him at work. But I will do my best to. It's like this last past week from Wednesday till now has been this incredible thread of healing. It started last Wednesday when Stephen and I and Regina, when we did our NTI discussion, and part of that was the Holy Spirit. He said, you know, I've already asked you to think with me by accepting my thoughts and laying your own thoughts aside. My thoughts are these. They are thoughts of forgiveness, love, acceptance, gratitude, and rejoicing. And when you talked about that, Regina, it struck you that those were ways of being. And as soon as you said that, it was kind of like highlighted in my mind as well. It was another way of looking at those, and I talked to Stephen a little bit about it afterwards, because there's a prayer in the 12-step group that says, you know, please remove my fear and direct my attention to what you would have me be. Not necessarily what would you have me do, but what would you have me be? And I just was struck by the similarity of that. And then I take these courses in through Pathways of Light, and I'm almost at the end, and I have been struggling. I think I mentioned this before. I've been struggling with getting down to the homework. I've talked a lot about it to Myron. You know, I'm always, you know, there's always something, and especially after reading chapters 4, 5, and 12 this week, and we can see that ego always got something in mind. But this particular last course that I'm on has a lot of meditations in it. There's a lot of CDs and meditations and imagery, and honestly, I think I've sat down like 5 separate times, you know, and would just get up with nothing. I would become distracted, to be honest. I would become distracted by something and stop. And so on Saturday night, I've had a lot of ego thoughts like, oh, just cancel your talk with Myron tomorrow. My oldest daughter was visiting from Boston on the weekend, although she was going to leave on Sunday morning to go back to Boston. You know, the thought was in my mind, just tell Myron that Maggie's in town and you're doing something with her. And you know, I'm just watching these thoughts, and I think, I'm not going to lie. I do know that. Lying is not happening. But I was also searching for, you know, some other way to not keep my appointment because I hadn't settled down. You know, I hadn't done my work. And so I thought, all right, why don't you just sit down and do your work? And if you get one section done with one meditation, then that's it. It's just if that's how it's going to be, then that's just how it's going to be. So I sat down and did, actually ended up doing two sections. But one of the sections was called a healing process. And it was, you know, to think of a relationship that was under stress or that you were having difficulty with, and to look at how you were identifying with the problem, which I saw, you know, that I had been identifying with, you know, fear and guilt and control, and that I'm somehow cut off from my children and grandchildren, and I seek their approval for my life, you know. That good mothers do this and good grandmothers do that, and trying to balance the scales all the time. And I just, writing this down, I said, you know, this takes energy and a lot of thinking and worry, and my time is spent in the past or the future. You know, I keep myself locked in the situation. And I wrote, I'm confused about where my safety lies. And then part of the process was reading this little prayer, you know, which I've done 5 times, but I was like, okay, I am patient and relaxed and willing to disidentify with the problems that I am holding in my mind. I'm willing to disidentify with them. And I saw that, you know, as the Course calls it, the mind's decision to be sick. I'm willing to disidentify with this one who thinks she has this problem. And I just asked, you know, Holy Spirit, you know, help me to receive awareness, because this meditation had this imagery of a funnel on top of your head, that there was the light of awareness, the light of God, the light of Spirit coming into your head and, you know, filling your heart. And I have tried that meditation, and I was just like, this dang funnel thing again, you know. And so, but I was on a little bit different role, and I was like, Holy Spirit, you know, help me to receive the awareness of my true nature. Please fill me with the light of my true self, and give me a peace and a knowing. And I let that knowing soften the hold that this pattern has had on me. Bring the light of insight in specific or general terms. And then I could feel it. Like, I can feel it when the Holy Spirit kicks in. And then it just, a shift happened. And what I wrote was, this is about how, not what. Nancy, this is how, not what. Be willing to see that you do not know who you are or what to do. Be willing to empty your active mind. Withdraw attention and worry. How, not what, or that phrase, how, not what, came from your aware self. So you see, it is there. Develop trust. Come frequently to this place of receiving. And how? Stay in acceptance, forgiveness, allowing, let mercy come more quickly, and trust. And I was like, I don't know, that probably sounds so like, duh, Nancy, but it came, I think that my aware self was that I had quieted my mind enough for it to step forward and to hear that. And just to hear it say, I emailed it to myself at work because I did not want to forget this, you know, this is, it's how, not what. how to be. It was reminded me of what you drew my attention to last week, Regina. These are how to be, not what should I do, what should I do, what should I do. I know that that's part of inquiry, but I seem to, it was necessary for me to hear that how I am to be. And so I was very grateful for that. And so and it didn't stop there. So then I go and I read my chapters out of Eternal Bliss for the week. And, you know, I was just like, you know, I have read these before, but of course, you know, like reading about choice A and choice B again. But the one that really, really got me was reading chapter 12, which is the Loving All Method, which honestly I haven't been paying very close attention to. And so reading that was really beautiful for me. And I, so the sequence of events was a couple days ago, I had, maybe it was even last night, I was looking on Facebook and I ran across, you know, how people post songs, old songs, and there was a Bee Gees song that someone posted, them singing Too Much Heaven. Is that the name of it? Too Much Heaven. I listened to it, and it just opened my heart so much. And I just listened to it, and I actually listened to it again on YouTube, looking at the lyrics of it, and I couldn't help it. I thought about Stephen and how that that's all I did. This was last night, and I thought, oh my God, that is so incredibly beautiful. So this morning is when I read chapter 12 in the Eternal Bliss book and the Loving All Method. And the very last, I mean, it's the chapter, which is short, is like a huge advertisement to do the Loving All Method. And that last paragraph in it, you know, it says, from time to time throughout the day, think of the person you love the most. Get in touch with the love that you feel for them. Then use that same feeling of love when practicing the Loving All Method. And earlier it had said that the Loving All Method is a new feeling habit. The practice is feeling, not thinking. It's a way to develop the habit of feeling love toward everything you perceive. No emotional resistance. And so his little recommendation at the end, his little, I guess that's what you call it, a recommendation to get in touch with the love that you feel for them, for that person in your life. And I remembered that song that I had heard the night before and how that made me feel. And it just felt like such confirmation, I guess, that I think the Loving All Method is so necessary because we have a tendency, or I have a tendency until now, to block the feelings that I do not want to feel. And I think the method works because if I block the feelings I don't want to feel, I also block this love. And so to learn to love all, and to use an example like that you can easily connect with, or to feel that expansive joy in the heart, which music and connection with others can bring to us. I do realize that this spirit's message to me was, you know, you do not know yourself, you know, as this love, and this is what you are, but this is a way to reach that goal, you know, by not blocking any feeling And the thought that I could feel about anything, the way that I felt about in those moments about Stephen and that song and the radiant feelings that came. And I know those feelings are not outside of me, that they're inside. And I loved that Spirit pointed that out, that that's where the message came from, that's where the emotion came from inside of it all. Okay, I think that's all I have to say about it. All right, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Nancy, for that lovely sharing. And I love that it's how, not what. I mean, that's just so simple and easy to remember, right? it reminds me of in the teachings of Inner Ramana. It was the same message, but different words. That it's where, but not what. Like, where am I going to be? Within the right mind or within the wrong mind, so to speak. Where and not what. So how and not what. I think it's the exact same message. So thank you for sharing that. Who else would like to share based on the last week of gentle healing? Okay, Ken, you're up.
I've started having thoughts in the morning, like memories, and when those memories will come up, there will be the feelings that were associated with those memories, which, as we know, is the belief. And I would start to withdraw, and then I realized and remembered to just say, this is nothing but an experience. Experience it. And within 5 seconds, the emotion was gone and the memory was gone. I would have trouble even trying to remember what it was that was causing the upset. And it's just something of, you know, memories will always be flowing through depending on what happens to trigger them. But those, that little tip, you know, it's an experience. It kind of is similar to when we did true meditation, and Adi Ashanti said, don't fight it, just let it be the little puppy running around loose in the yard, and it'll eventually run out of energy. But it's when you keep the puppy on a leash that it never is allowed to run around. And that's kind of, this is a new look on that of, we have the feelings to experience them. It's like, why do you go to an amusement park? Why do you go on thrill rides? To feel them, to experience them.
And why do you go to a movie? And why do you read a novel, right?
All the whys. It is to experience it. So when you fight it, and you repress it, and you say, I don't want to feel that, well, why'd you go on the thrill ride if you don't want to feel it? You're missing the whole point of the thrill ride. And this is a, you know, the ultimate thrill ride is life. And that was just such an amazing little insight of a new little tool to diffuse the old memories. And we had, or we have the blessing of having Laura visit us. And the morning after, she came and spent the night with us because her dog and Jamie are not compatible. So she came to visit us. And the next morning we were sitting out over coffee and talking, and out of my mouth pops, would you like to live with us? I don't know whether my jaw dropped the second that came out of my mouth, but internally it did, of Ken, the personality, is saying, what are you doing? You just met this person yesterday and you're asking her to live with you. And I looked over at Becky, because normally before I will do something like that, I'll always check with her.
Of course.
And after it came out of my mouth, I looked over at her and she's just going, uh-huh. And I still, other than my heart opening to Laura's heart, I still have no clue. But it was that supreme surrender to guidance, which is what Laura talks about, of surrendering to her guidance. Why else would you walk around the country for 2.5 years if you weren't surrendered to guidance? So, you came back yesterday, Laura?
Yes.
So, we now have three new housemates. We have Laura, we have Surrender, her dog, who is a therapy dog for our dog, and also a therapy dog for our new Sheba. So, thank you.
Yeah, you know, and so in a way, a lot has happened since last Tuesday. Last Tuesday, I don't know if y'all remember, but that was the day that Ken and Rebecca put down one of their dogs, Tiggs, right, Tiggis? Yep. And Tag, their other dog, you know, missed Tiggis, of course, but I saw Tag 3 times in 1 week. And each time I saw Tag seemed a lot worse. And in fact, the third time I saw Tag, my thought was that he might die, you know, of a broken heart. So that's like, you know, how you have these subplots going on. That's one subplot. Another subplot is my friend Laura came to town, and I was going to invite her to stay the week with me, but Jamie just was not at all excited about having this other dog in the house, and Jamie actually became somewhat vicious. And so Laura asked, you know, do you want me to leave? And I'm like, yes, because it would just be way too much trouble to try and keep these two dogs apart. You know, it would just be a constant effort. So I took Laura and dropped her off somewhere, thinking that she was leaving the area, right? And Laura, I don't know if you want to tell your part of the story, or if I would tell it right. Do you want to come tell your part of the story when you started walking towards Boone?
You can tell it.
Okay, I won't tell it the way she would, of course. But she started walking east of Pueblo towards Boone and started having this strong feeling to turn around, right?
The white truck. Did I tell you the white truck?
Yeah, but I've forgotten. Come tell the story. Yeah, I don't remember things.
Hi, everybody.
This is Laura, and you got to talk into the blue ball there.
Yeah, so I was headed. I was almost to Boone. I'd walked all day. And this white pickup truck, and Spirit knows I have kind of a connection. If I'm not really sure what to do, there's one of the things Spirit talks me through is white vehicles. And this white pickup truck going the other direction stops in the media, or in the on the shoulder, and then backs up. So this looks very dangerous to me.
Yeah.
It's happening on the other side of the highway. Like, why would you do that? And I just thought, oh my gosh. And then it went a long way, and then it just pulled back out into the lane and continued on. And I was like, I'm supposed to turn around. And so that's what I did. Yeah, I went through a little bit of inner, you know, really?
Yeah, after walking all day.
Yeah.
And being kicked out of Gina's house, right? I know. But so she ended up getting a ride, and you know, we didn't know it last Tuesday night when we were sitting here, but she was back in Pueblo West, and we didn't know that. She was camping. Wednesday morning, am I getting all the days right? I think I am.
Yeah.
Wednesday morning she texted me and said that she was in Pueblo West again at the campgrounds, and immediately I thought, you know, maybe this is what Tag needs. You know, Tag needs another dog. So I contacted Rebecca and Ken and asked them if they wanted to let Laura stay with them. And what I told them was it might be good for Tag, because that's genuinely what I felt. And so they weren't sure, of course. They didn't know Laura, you know, from Adam, as the saying goes. So we went out to breakfast together in the park with the dogs, and they talked to her and ended up inviting her to come and spend the night. And it was like a miracle for Tag. I mean, Tag just, it was like a resurrection. Tag just came all the way back. It was pretty amazing. So it must have been 2 weeks ago that you put Tiggis down, not one.
Yeah.
Because otherwise I wouldn't have had time to observe the deterioration in Tag. So, then as Ken has told you, he invited Laura to stay. And Laura, again, just felt like walking. So she ended up doing some more walking. She walked for about 3 or 4 days. But yesterday she contacted me. She was in Walsenburg, and I went down and picked her up and brought her back. And so now she and her dog, Surrender, whom we call Surrey, and Tag, and then the new dog, Sheba, which was adopted last Friday, are all getting to know each other. Getting to know you. Getting to know all about you. You guys know The King and I, that song from The King and I? So that's what's happening here. So a lot has happened in a week. A lot of change has occurred. And we're all just watching it to see where it goes. So that's
Surrender.
So that's our story, and we're sticking to it.
Yep.
All right. Does anybody else have something they would like to share? All right, then. Why don't I begin my sharing, and I will begin sharing from the most direct means to eternal bliss. One thing I do just want to say, kind of a commercial for those of you who haven't heard yet, on Sunday night of this week, September 3rd, I will be interviewing Bentinho Massaro in the Awakening Together Sanctuary. That will start at 7:30 Eastern Time, which is 4:30 in the afternoon in the Pacific Coast. And I've interviewed Bentinho before. Some of you may have been around when I did that. That was back in September of 2014, a long time ago. And then in October of 2015, he was our retreat leader at the Fall Retreat, or one of our retreat leaders that year. So I've interviewed him before, but the reason I am interviewing him again is that Kathy Smith pointed out to me a few months ago that Bentinho was recommending The Direct Means to Eternal Bliss and Seven Steps to Awakening to all of his retreatants. Before they came to the retreat, he wanted them to read these books. And, you know, that's just not the Bentinho I knew. So I'm like, what happened? So I have invited Bentinho back, and I want to interview him again and find out, you know, where he's been since we last saw him in Awakening Together in October 2015, and what has brought him to Michael Langford's books as a part of his curriculum. I did chat with Bentinho today, and he was asking me questions about Michael. So I hadn't told him that I knew Michael, but he must have, you know, heard that through the grapevine or found out somehow. So he was asking me questions about Michael. And, you know, we're both looking forward to Sunday night. So please come and join us. So I'm going to start with sharing from The Direct Means to Eternal Bliss. We looked at chapters 4, 5, and 12. So chapter 4, The Desire for Freedom. And as you all know, Michael says that this is the most important first step that can be taken towards liberation, and it is also the most important key. And what's interesting is NTI in its own way says the same thing. NTI calls it willingness in the beginning when it appears to be small, and calls it true desire later when it's, you know, more full blown. But NTI also clearly says that this willingness or this true desire is what's most important. It's the most important key. So this is something that we all really want to keep in mind. And, you know, NTI recommends having gratitude for your willingness, even if it seems to be very, very small. Because whatever we have gratitude for, as we know, expands. And so just having gratitude for whatever willingness is there. And the real goal is to allow that willingness, or to allow that desire for freedom, to get bigger and bigger and bigger, because there's a lot of benefits to a really strong desire for freedom, which of course Michael covers in this chapter. He talks about what the extremely intense desire for freedom is, and he gives several examples, and my guess is that each of us probably resonated with some of the examples more than others. For example, even when I was with Michael, I told him I don't resonate with this one very much, that a part of the extremely intense desire for freedom is the extremely intense longing for the final end of all suffering and sorrow. And I told him that one, you know, that one, I don't really even think about that much. That's probably because I don't feel like I'm suffering, you know, so because I don't feel like I'm suffering, I don't long for the end of suffering, right? But somebody who's suffering might. But the two that really stand out for me, so this is a very personal sharing here, the two that really stand out for me, which are really two ways of saying the same thing, the extremely intense desire for freedom is the extremely intense desire for the direct experience of absolute truth, and the extremely intense desire to experience who or what you really are at your core. And when I read those two lines, I can really feel that. That matters very, very much to me. And like I said, I assume everyone probably found certain lines in that paragraph that resonated for them. And Danielle, when you feel like taking a walk, I'm thirsty.
Oh,
okay. It'll help to talk if I had a drink. Hold on, you can take this back and I'll just signal you whenever I need a drink. I forgot to bring my own tonight. Danielle used to not share drinks. Can I tell stories about you, Danielle?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, of course, I'm not saying that Danielle's over the unworthiness thing, because that would just be a big fat lie. But there has been a reduction. And Danielle used to not share drinks because she felt so unworthy, that she felt that there was something very, very wrong with her, and whatever it was, I might catch it. You know, and she wouldn't let me use her iPad, right? Or anything where I might catch whatever this unworthiness was that she had. So it's really cool that she'll get up, walk over here, and let me drink out of her water bottle. That's what we call healing. Yeah, thank you, Danielle. And she was never afraid of my germs. She was just afraid of me getting her germs. Yeah. So a lot of healing has happened here. Michael says, of all the factors that determine if you will or will not be free, the intensity or lack of intensity of your desire for freedom is the most essential factor. Whatever you can do to most effectively increase your desire for freedom should be done. And, I mean, I just perceive this as nothing but a fact. If I do not have the desire for freedom, I'm going to spend my time differently. I'm not going to get up in the morning, and I'm not going to go to contemplation, and I'm not going to go to meditation unless I have a strong desire for freedom. There are so many other things I can be doing. You know, work alone, although it's a quote spiritual job. The truth is, you know, I could use work alone as a distraction from the genuine practice that I have to do. I could get up every morning and start work right away and not spend any time in contemplation or meditation. And so the desire for freedom, the desire for awakening, or in my case, the desire for the direct experience of the absolute truth, the desire to experience who or what I really am at my core. I can feel those just reading those lines. This is what leads me to set that alarm for 5 a.m. every morning, and then to literally get up within 10 minutes of the alarm going off. I used to always lay there for at least an hour after the alarm started going off. Now I'm up within 10 minutes. I'm usually up even before the first snooze, so usually less than the 9 minutes, to get up and to go directly into contemplation and meditation. That's because of this desire for freedom, right? And without this desire of freedom, We spend our time differently. That's all there is to it. So one way you can tell if you have a desire for freedom is literally by looking at how you spend your time. You know, and then if you aren't spending your time with the spiritual practice that awakens, you know, that's not something to beat yourself up about. That's just to realize, oh, I need to increase my desire for freedom. And of course, Michael has a suggestion, chapter 5, on how to increase your desire for freedom. And, you know, what I suspect is the reason he recommends really looking at these choice A's and choice B's is because that's what really helped him. That's what I suspect. I'll tell you what helps me, and it's so crazy. What helps me is the spiritual practice. If I get my butt out of bed and I spend my time in contemplation and meditation, the next day I want to do it. It's the practice itself, in my case, that increases my desire. Because when I get into the contemplation, I love it. And when I get into the meditation, I love it. And when I do it, I remember how much I love it. And then that gets me doing it. If I start missing a day, then pretty soon a second day, then pretty soon a third day, because it's like my mind will quickly forget how much I love it. And then pretty soon I'm not doing it again. So for me, doing it is what increases the desire to do it. But each of us has to find our own way to increase that desire for freedom. Michael says, all obstacles that appear in your journey to freedom are caused by too little desire for freedom. As your desire for freedom grows in intensity, the ego creates fewer obstacles. You know, this is just something that I put my faith in once. I did feel like I was too busy to take time for meditation and contemplation. You know, Awakening Together was just getting started. There were so many things that had to be done. And I would get up at 5 or 6 in the morning, but I would go directly to work, and I would work every minute until I went to bed. And I just couldn't figure out how I would find the 3 or 4 hours to do the work, to do the spiritual work, because there was just so much that had to be done. And then, maybe possibly reading these sentences actually, but I don't know that for a fact. I thought, you know what? I just have to put my faith in the fact that if I really want this, things will take care of themselves, and there will be time to do it. And, you know, there's a story. I can't remember if I told you guys this story once or someone else. I did tell the story recently. There's a story, a Kabbalistic story, about when Moses split the Red Sea. But the story is that he didn't actually do it alone. There was another man there, and I can't remember his name. But when Moses was getting ready to, you know, hit the staff down, really God split the Red Sea, right? But when Moses was getting ready to knock the staff down and God was going to split the Red Sea, this other man had so much faith that God would split the Red Sea that he started walking into the Red Sea even though it wasn't split yet. And he got all the way up to neck level water, and he was still walking forward, and that's when God split the Red Sea. And so I kind of had that feeling about my busyness. I thought, even though I don't have time to take time for contemplation and meditation, maybe I need to walk into the Red Sea. Maybe I need to take that time. And then after I decide to take the time and start taking it, something will happen that things will start being rearranged so that things will start being taken off of my plate so that I actually have the time. And that's just what I have experienced. You know, I have experienced more people showing up, more people offering to take things that I used to do. You know, Gloria is now responsible for the Ministers Association. Lisa Hester very soon is going to be taking responsibility for the retreat house portion of the website. Of course, Ken, you know, has shown up as a sanctuary director, but he does a lot of other things that are a big help. He's recently taken the radio off of my plate. He's helping me out with the website. Of course, Jacqueline, you know, took the Sot songs and different things that I used to, I used to do all this stuff. All the stuff that Jacqueline and Ken and me and Lisa and Gloria, and I'm probably leaving some people out, do. I used to do all of it. No wonder I was busy, right? And now it's slowly getting shifted out to where other people are taking it, and that is giving me the time that I need for my spiritual work. But what I was trusting again was this idea that as my desire for freedom increased, the obstacles that seemed to keep me from practice would be reduced, right? And so I needed to increase that desire for freedom, and I felt I needed to put not my money where my mouth is, my habits where my mouth is. I had to go ahead and start taking the time even though I didn't feel like I had it. I had to start walking into that Red Sea, and then everything else would work itself out. He says, when your desire for freedom is weak, the ego does not allow you to see its preservation strategies. When the desire for freedom is stronger, you can begin to see the ego's preservation strategies. When the desire for freedom becomes even stronger, the desire for freedom itself will bring you everything you need to succeed. The desire for freedom will bring you everything you need to succeed in your quest for freedom, including the answer to all your questions, the direct path teachings, the solution to all obstacles, the motivation to practice, etc., right? So, that paragraph really outlines just how important this desire for freedom is. And if you go to NTI Galatians, I think it's NTI Galatians chapter 5, italicized right in the middle of the page, you're going to find a very similar paragraph that only uses the word willingness, right? It says that your willingness brings all of these things. Again, the desire for freedom brings everything you need to succeed in your quest for freedom, including the answer to all your questions, the direct path teachings, the solution to all obstacles, the motivation to practice, etc. One thing that's really important about the desire for freedom is that as the desire for freedom increases, you will see your ego better. The ego kind of reminds me of a magician. A magician is actually just performing tricks, right? They're not really performing magic. But what happens is they know how to distract us so that we don't see the mechanics of the trick, and it seems like magic. And that's the same thing with the ego. It knows how to distract us so that we don't see its mechanics. But as the desire for freedom increases, we start to see the mechanics of our own ego. And my experience is, and I would imagine that when your desire for freedom is less, you might see those things with judgment. Judgment being the ego. But as your desire for freedom increases, my experience is, I don't see my ego with judgment. I see my ego with, aha, there's another little piece, another little clue about how this can be undone. In fact, last week, remember, I sat here and shared with you all how I had seen that clue that I had identified with the fact that, I walk my talk, that I live the teachings, and I hadn't seen that identification before. So as our desire for freedom increases, we see more and more and more of the ego's tricks. And as those tricks come into awareness, we become free of those tricks, which means we're less and less and less tied up with the ego, right? We're more and more free as our desire for freedom increases. And of course, one thing, unfortunately I've observed this, he says, without an increase in your desire for freedom, the ego will distort all of your spiritual studies, including what you read in this book. And I have certainly observed, many, many people that are not yet clear on the difference between spiritual teachings that awaken and spiritual teachings that just keep you in a spiritual community. just keep you feeling spiritual. There really is a very clear and obvious difference. It's not even a matter of opinion. Again, once that desire for freedom increases, you see it as it's like night and day. I mean, you know, it's a very obvious difference. But until that desire for freedom is really strong, there can be a lot of confusion regarding spiritual teachings. And we can put a lot of time and a lot of effort into spiritual teachings that are going nowhere really, really fast. They're keeping us in a spiritual community. They're keeping us in a spiritual identity. But they really aren't doing anything at all to set us free. And so again, the clarity of which spiritual teachings are truly helpful towards awakening, that comes with that increased desire for awakening. Of course, another great key, and he doesn't number it as number two, he just says another great key, but I'll just call it a number two. If number one is that intense desire for freedom, number two is being self-honest. But I would also say, and this is based on my own experience, that what enables you to be self-honest is the desire for freedom, right? It goes hand in hand. As you want awakening more, then you also want to be self-honest more. They go together. And again, he's talking about seeing your ego and seeing its preservation strategy, seeing the arguments it creates that keeps you from your spiritual practice. Of course, he talks about as your, you know, desire for freedom doubles, you know, that's a really big, big help. And he uses this example. Imagine someone being held underwater. How eager is he to rise to the surface to breathe air? Your desire for freedom must be intense as that man's desire for air, right? And he talks about that quite a bit. But I think this is my favorite part of that discussion. You know, he's talking about how when your desire for freedom really, really increases, you know, many, many times, he says, then you would be just like the man who is being held underwater trying to rise up for air. And then these sentences are my favorite. He does not have time for discussion. He does not have time for games. He does not have time for false teachers. He does not have time for indirect methods. He does not have time for endless reading. He does not have time for television. He does not have time for projecting an imagined meaning onto the teachings. He does not have time for entertainment. He does not have time for pretending to want to be free. He does not have time for any dishonesty with himself. He does not have time for pretending he has risen to the surface. He does not have time for any debate or argument. And you know, I haven't really seen it with this particular group, and I want to say that directly. I really value that I haven't seen it with this particular group. But with so many spiritual groups that I've worked with in the past, you know, I see discussion, debate, I'm right about this, you're wrong about this, all of that being a part of the spiritual path. And if you think about it, again, if you want freedom as much as you want air, you know, like if you were being held underwater, and think about how much you would want air, you don't have time for that kind of discussion and debate. You don't have time to go on Facebook and say, oh no, you're wrong. This is what the Course says, and this is what the Course... You don't have time for that. When you see that, you're going to walk away from that, and you're going to go immediately into your own contemplation, meditation, and maybe helpful reading that helps you with that. But you just don't have time. You just don't have time for those kinds of things. Again, I think you guys know my favorite line out of A Course in Miracles is, the miracle worker's only responsibility is to accept the atonement for himself. And I think that as our desire for freedom increases, that's really all we have time for, right? All we have time for is awakening. And in my particular case, that doesn't look like, at least so far, I can't speak for the future, that doesn't look like what it looked like for Michael. You know, Michael, When you read his books, he'll tell you that he meditated more days, 12 hours, than days that weren't 12 hours, you know. And my life does not look like that. And Michael knows my life does not look like that. And he has told me that what I am doing is, you know, what I need to be doing. He doesn't want me to quit Awakening Together and start meditating 12 hours a day. That wouldn't be what's in the best interest for me. But what does happen for me is that no matter what I'm doing, whether I'm working, whether I'm being with Ron on the weekend, whether I'm walking Jamie or whatever I'm doing, I am constantly contemplating truth. Like my mind is always, always, always there. And contemplating truth for me is not like thinking about the metaphysics. To me, that's a form of entertainment. Contemplating truth means noticing that I am awareness. Noticing my joy. Noticing my acceptance. Noticing my openness to others. You know, we were reading NTI earlier today, some friends that are in the MPP group that I lead. And NTI talks about the singular thought of God, holding on to that singular thought of God. And to me, that's what my desire for freedom has done, is it's finally brought it in where there's a singular thought of God, and it's just always, always, always with me when I'm watching the news, when I'm talking with friends. And used to, it wasn't. Used to, you know, I might be contemplating truth during my 3 hours in the morning, but then when I stepped out with friends or stepped out with Jasmine, I totally forgot about it. You know, and it wouldn't be until I came back to my evening practice that I remembered again. And that totally forgetting is not happening now. It's just always right here. And so that's how, so I do have that time in the morning, as you know, where I contemplate and meditate. But for me, the rest of it is just always being aware of truth, always abiding as that truth, rather than abiding as the ego, right? Instead of being the person that the ego would have me be. He does talk about the only effective means to end the ego is to turn your attention away from thought, the body, the world, people, places, things, experiences, etc., and turn your attention towards awareness, watching awareness. And we even saw that in A Course in Miracles not too long ago, where A Course in Miracles says, only the light, I can't remember the exact quote, but it was something like, only the light has the power to awaken you. Something like that. Do you guys remember that line? It was in one of our lessons.
There's a question on the
board. A question on the board. I wondered if we could be awareness watching awareness as we go through our day with eyes open, just watching. There's a matter of degree there, which has become very important to me, and I think it might be very important. There is an ability to be aware of awareness. There is an ability to pay attention to that during the day, but it's not as deep as when you sit down and close your eyes and pay attention. And the reason is because when you're out and about in the world, you also have to be paying attention to other things, you know.
Distractions.
Yeah, you have to. I mean, you have to pay attention to your driving. You have to pay attention to crossing the street. You have to pay attention to an email you're typing. You know, and so because you have to pay attention outwardly, even though you can still place some attention with the fact that you are awareness, it doesn't have the same degree. And I think there's power in that deeper degree of when you can sit down, close your eyes, ignore everything, and just pay attention to awareness. What I personally recommend is doing both. I recommend taking time every day for that deep awareness, watching awareness, but then during the day, noticing that you are awareness. I call that mini glimpses throughout the day. And that has become a habit of mine. I used to call it, if you listen to some of my older teachings, I used to call it checking. Checking, you know, checking, noticing that I'm still awareness. And in fact, You may have heard me tell the story that when I got thrown from the horse, you know, I was in so much pain. Anybody that's ever been thrown from a horse, you know, that's galloping may know what I'm talking about. But what was interesting is when I hit the ground and I felt all of that pain in my body, the very first thing I did was check. And I noticed that awareness was unchanged. You know, so even then it was a habit. Checking became a habit. And now I almost abide in that checking in a more consistent way. Like I'm aware of awareness in a more consistent way. I'm aware of the body being in awareness, etc. But it still doesn't have the depth to it of closing my eyes and going into awareness, watching awareness meditation. So if you were going to give up one or the other, I would give up the checking or the glimpses and go for the deep meditation. But I recommend doing both.
Michael said the loving all method was the one you do.
Yeah, Michael, right. Yeah, Michael recommends the loving all method, which of course was the chapter 12. And you know, let me just skip on over to chapter 12. We'll see. I might not even talk about chapter 5. We'll see if I have time. Chapter 5 was choice A and choice B. Which hopefully everyone read it, but let me skip on over to chapter 12. The loving all method is really a favorite of mine. I started practicing it before I read it in Michael's book. I learned it from The Untethered Soul. In The Untethered Soul, it's called unconditional happiness. But in my interpretation, unconditional happiness and the loving all method are the same thing, even though they're using different words. And when I read about, it's chapter 15 in The Untethered Soul, when I read about unconditional happiness, I knew that that was a critical part of my spiritual path. And I knew that I needed to commit to unconditional happiness. And here we go, Danielle, I'll tell another story about you. You ready for it to be told in public?
I guess I know which one it is.
Remember, it's the day...
Oh, yeah.
Okay, good. This is another healing because for a long time she didn't want me to tell the story. All right. So Danielle used to live with me, and I thought I was clear that I only wanted one dog in the house. And what Danielle did one day is she went out with her mom, I think it was, and got a dog and then told me about it after the fact. And I was just like, oh, I just don't want two dogs, you know, and I don't remember what all I said then, but, you know, the idea was I didn't want another dog here, and I think probably that the dog would have to stay at her parents' house or something. Do you remember, Danielle, how that came about? I don't remember. I don't remember the details. This was like the day after I took the vow of unconditional happiness, but anyway, it really was. It was the next day. Or maybe I think I took the vow on Friday, and this might have been a Sunday. Did you get Shiloh on a Sunday? Do you remember?
I don't remember.
Yeah, it was very, very close. But anyway, you know, I think I was telling Danielle that I really wasn't okay with this, and Danielle got really mad. And if you know Danielle, that's not something that happens often. You know, Danielle and Jasmine, I lived together like in perfection almost. Jasmine would get mad sometimes, but still, it was a pretty perfect life. But Danielle got so mad at me, and she ran out and slammed the door. And then Jasmine got mad at me for making Danielle mad, and she ran in her bedroom and slammed the door. And again, these kinds of blow-ups didn't happen in our house. We were just three little happy girls, right? And I had just taken this vow of happiness, and I did not feel happy at all. And I just sat there in the floor. And I think, you know, the way I remember is I just felt frustrated. I felt frustrated that things weren't as perfect as they always are. And I sat there and I asked, now how do I be happy with this? And the answer that came was, be happy with feeling frustrated. Right? So, you know, and this is the kind of thing Michael tries to explain in the Loving All Method. We think that being happy all the time, it was unconditional happiness in my case, or loving everything is supposed to mean that we always feel one way. And the truth is, once we become masters at it, that might be pretty close to the truth, right? Once we become masters at unconditional happiness or masters at the loving all method, we may feel, you know, pretty consistent. But in the beginning, you know, for me it was day two or day three, that's just not the case. And so what we do is we love what is. So if what is that Danielle and Jasmine and I just had our first fight in 5 years and I'm feeling all frustrated, I love the feeling frustrated. You know, or I feel, or I'd be happy. In my case, it was be happy with being frustrated because I had the unconditional happiness. And that's what he's trying to explain in the loving all method. Again, it's, you kind of start wherever you're at and you love that. So in fact, he says, and by the way, the end of that story is probably within an hour or two, Danielle came back. And her and me and Jasmine made up and we went out to lunch together. And Shiloh and I are now best of friends. End of story. Right? Do you want to say anything?
No.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
They don't even know that you're really alive. They think you're a figment of my imagination.
That's okay with me.
Yeah.
She's a figment of all of our imaginations.
Then. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, you know, if we go with our movie that we saw, Welcome to Happiness, what ended up happening in this case, you know, maybe sounds not good, but I think it probably was good. I liked Shiloh, but I really wasn't crazy about having another dog. I was trying to learn to meditate. Shiloh is very active in the mornings, and it really wasn't working perfectly, just like it wasn't working perfectly with Surrey in my house, right? And so Danielle decided to move out. And, you know, at first it kind of sounds like, oh, shucks, that all sucks. But the truth is, 5 mornings a week now, I'm at home all by myself. And I do get into very deep contemplation and very deep meditation. And I think that's perfect. I really like being by myself so that I can focus on this work. And Danielle, I think, really likes living in her new house, right? Yeah, so you know, everything works out the way it works out. It all works out for the best. So now, do you want to say anything?
No.
Someday I'm going to get Danielle over to the mic. Mark my words, right? Because I mean, she let me drink out of her drink. She let me tell the Shiloh story. The mic is coming. In fact, I wonder if we can get you to sing. I sing. I used to think I would never sing on the mic.
Thanks.
she's not ready, but we'll see what happens in a year or two. All right, the loving all method. Let me see what I want to share from the loving all method. Again, this is really important. He says, no changes in external behavior are required. If, you know, and he uses the example, if someone were to try to punch you in the face and you would normally duck, you will also duck while practicing the loving all method. Loving the fact that someone is trying to punch you does not mean you will not duck. You also love ducking to avoid being punched. Well, I'm not going to claim to be a master, but I'm pretty good at this loving all method now. And knock on wood, now something's going to happen tomorrow. But anyway, and I'm pretty good at this happiness. Yes. Oh, well, where's the question? It seems it may take some time before I can do a full 20 minutes of AWA with my eyes closed. I do 20 minutes going back and forth between eyes open and eyes closed. Can you say something about this? Is this a good approach? Is that because you get sleepy? Is that the reason? I need to know that answer first. Okay. Are there other reasons besides the fact that you get sleepy? When I have my eyes open, it seems to be a bit of a strain. Okay, so you've been practicing the open-eyed method that Ellie Ruzdar, and that's what I'm assuming, that Ellie Ruzdar taught, and then that's a bit of a strain, so you close your eyes, and then you go back to open. That's the way I'm understanding this. For me, sleepiness was a big problem, not a little problem. And then one day it occurred to me, and this maybe is just because the desire for freedom increased and therefore a solution came. But one day it occurred to me that I could watch the sleepiness rather than being the sleepiness. I could watch the sleepiness, and then after I watched the sleepiness, then kind of ask the question, you know, what is it that's aware of this sleepiness, and turn my attention to awareness. And I learned to abide in awareness even as the mind was falling asleep. It almost feels like I learned to, like the falling asleep was in front of me, and I was able to stay behind it in awareness. And I was in the mind, I feel certain, did go ahead and go to sleep. But I was able to abide in awareness and stay aware as the mind was sleeping. Watch the sleeper. And that is how I finally overcame, I transcended falling asleep. So that was my experience. With the eyes open and the eyes closed thing, I think I told you all I started with eyes open. That was easier for me. But as I don't ever want to use the word advanced with me, with Regina and meditation in the same sentence. I don't think that has anything to do with each other. But as I became more advanced beginner, how's that?
Yes. More practiced.
More practiced. There we go. I started dropping the open eye thing and started only doing eyes closed. So, at first I would do eyes open for, quite a bit of time. And then I started doing eyes open. I eventually got to where I was only doing eyes open for like 30 seconds. And now I go directly to eyes closed. I don't do eyes open meditation at all. So that might just come with practice.
Jacqueline has her hand up.
Jacqueline has her hand up. Okay, Jacqueline, the mic is yours. Maybe she doesn't know where she has her hand up. Oops. Oops, what? Yeah, maybe she didn't know she had her hand up. So is that, oops, you didn't mean to have your hand up? Yeah, okay. All right. Let me go back to this loving awe method. I think I want to go back to the loving awe method. Yeah, this is really important, at least to me. If someone says something mean to you and you feel bad emotionally because of what they said, love the negative emotion as it is and love yourself. This is similar to what happened, when Jasmine and Danielle and I had that fight over Shiloh. I mean, I don't remember Danielle saying anything mean to me. I think she just went out and slammed the door. But she'd never done that before. You know, that was the first time she'd done that. And again, emotionally, I wasn't feeling good about this. This wasn't going the way I wanted things to go. and the guidance that came was to be happy with feeling frustrated. Or if I was doing the loving awe method, it would be to love the feeling of frustration. And I just think this is critical. I don't think this is a minor point. I think this is how we become masters. We have to love everything as it is, which means if I am super, super angry, I need to pause and look at that feeling of anger. Really, the way I do is I really explore the feeling. You know, how does the feeling feel in my chest? You know, really look at it and love the experience of anger, or love the experience of guilt, or love the experience of fear. And I really feel that this is critical. And what the mind wants to tell you is you shouldn't be angry, or you shouldn't be fearful, or you shouldn't be feeling guilty. You should have transcended that. And the method of transcending that is loving it as like it is while it's there. Kathy, I saw your hand go up. Do you want to take the mic? Okay, Danielle, I'm ready. Is she not taking the mic?
Nope.
Okay.
I could share.
I'm going to take that.
But I haven't done the homework, so if I shouldn't share.
Oh, yeah, we have a rule. No sharing unless you've done the homework. Yeah. Okay, so let's see. I think that's all I really want to share about this. He does say, in action, you can resist all you want to resist. Don't resist emotionally. So that would mean, for example, I got a good example. I told you all a moment ago that I like being alone, and I really was going to invite Laura to stay. That was okay with me. But for the most part, I don't actually even want guests right now in my house because I want to have those mornings alone. And then, to be honest, the rest of the day I'm working my butt off. And that feels perfect for me right now. And if I was to add guests to the scene, I think what would probably get pushed out would be that meditation contemplation time. And I just don't want that to happen. So, when someone calls me and they ask if they can come to my house, the lying ego tells me that I have to say yes. I don't have to say yes. I can say no, but you could call Ken and Rebecca. They might let you come. But I don't have to say yes. And see, that's what the lying ego tells us, that we have to, being okay with everything as it is means if somebody calls me and asks if they can come to my house, I have to say yes. And that's just not true. And again, if I listen to the lying ego, I bet you guys a dollar that, you know, 2 or 3 months down the road from now, I would be back into not meditating and not contemplating because it got pushed right out of my life.
If you were truly spiritual, you'd say yes to everybody.
If I was truly spiritual, I'd let them all come to my house. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
So just remember that, you know, that the ego is going to try and trick you with the loving all method, right? And Michael's very clear, this doesn't change what you would do. It changes the way you're emotionally feeling about it. So if I did feel guilty, if I said no to somebody and then felt guilty, what do I do with that?
You love it.
I love feeling guilty about saying no. Exactly. But you see, it's not the behavior that's changing. It's learning to be emotionally open with whatever you are experiencing. That's the difference.
If you don't judge it, which is guilt.
Yeah,
judging.
Yes, guilt comes from judgment.
If you don't judge it, which is what the loving all method is saying, don't judge it.
That is what it's saying. Yes, don't judge it. So that's all I'm going to cover. Now, Kathy's hand is up again, so that's good. I want to hear from Kathy.
Can you guys hear me? Yes, thank you. You know, it occurs to me as we're talking about this loving all method, and of course it starts off saying, you know, love everything, just love everything basically. And if you can't love it, accept it. If you can't accept it, at least allow it. And so it feels like it's still addressing the egoic side of the mind rather than... you know, the pure self, because the pure self would always love everything. I mean, it is the essence of the pure self. It's all there is. And so this practice, I don't know what I'm trying to say here. I guess what I'm feeling is that the more I step into the truth of who I am, the more I notice each time I find myself off track and, you know, put a stop to it in that I don't add any more fuel to it by thinking about it some more. And towards this self that is love, that is how we go, or I go from maybe sometimes just being able to allow it, you know, and not necessarily love it, but at least allow it. And our practices, of course, are leading us to strengthening that bond between, you know, this identification with a false self that seemingly can only, you know, allow something because it can't quite love it completely. And the more into, or the more I step into the truth, the easier the loving all method has to become. It just has to,
yeah.
Because the truth is that I am only love. And so that would be the only expression in every single situation. But note lets me know, you know, not turn towards that. The ego says, turn to me. Turn away from that. You know, turn away from that. So really kind of paying attention. Each time, I guess, I find myself making an exception to loving it or allowing it or at least accepting it. At any rate, I'm going to give up the mic. Thanks.
Yeah, I would say that the ego really thrives. Not, you know, obviously it thrives on your attention. But in addition to that, it really thrives on you, you know, believing judgments and resistance. It thrives on judgment and resistance. And so when we practice the loving all method, and it is practice the loving all method, which means we aren't fully ourself yet or fully abiding as ourself yet, right? We still are attached to the ego. But when we're practicing the loving all method, what we're doing is we're taking the wind out of the ego. Since the wind that blows up the ego is judgment and resistance, and we're learning not to judge and not to resist, we're actively weakening the ego. And then I think that you are correct in that as we become more and more aware of ourself, the loving all method becomes more and more natural. And for me, the words love and happiness have become synonymous. You know, once upon a time I would have said love was one thing and happiness was another thing. And I don't see it that way anymore. To me, love and happiness are synonymous. Being happy with something, loving something is the same thing. Is it helpful to ask who is it that sees this frustration? Yes, that can be helpful. Because if you shift into awareness, you're going to see it differently. So that can be very helpful. Yeah. Are there any other questions before we move away from the most direct means to eternal bliss into our new book?
Clarification.
Yes.
When I've read the Loving All Method, my understanding of it is that it is not asking you to love everything you see in the world. It is asking you to love how you react to it and not judge your reaction.
Well, that's, I think this is why I say for me, love and happiness have become the same thing because it's really talking about how you feel all the time and nothing knocks you off of that feeling eventually. So, you know, like, so you're right. It's not an outward projecting, emotion. Like you wouldn't say, oh, I love that, you know, people are dying in a flood in Arizona or in Texas. I love that people are dying in a flood in Texas. You know, that's a crazy thing to say. But people are dying in a flood in Texas and I still love. See, it doesn't knock me off of my loving. It doesn't knock me off of my happiness. That's a constant beingness. That's what I am. Right?
Yeah. It's referring to what's inside of you.
Yes. Yes.
Not what we observe or experience or perceive in the world. It's our reaction, which is internal.
It's like Nancy was talking about. It's really a state of being. You know, she said we read that in NTI last week. It's really a state of being. You're learning to be love or be joy, right? Yeah, and in fact, you know, again, it gets really, really tough because the ego wants to point at certain situations and say, how could you love that? And again, it's not about that. It's about that internal, I'm gonna, you know, you, like you said, you may still resist that, right? But internally, I love the experience of being, really, is what ends up being. I love the experience of being, and nothing knocks me off of that love.
Because judgment is what's going to knock you off. That's the source of suffering.
Yeah, and in life, things happen.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you just can't make that stop. And that's one of the spiritual delusions, is that, you know, when we become awakened enough, crap will stop happening. You know, crap still happens. It's going to happen till the day you die. The question is, how do you see it?
Right. We had to put our dog down. Did I love that? No. But I love the sadness.
Yeah, you can love the sadness. You can love the sweetness of the sadness. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, you know, I, as you guys who are here with me know, I have a bad back right now. And I don't know, I don't even have any resistance at all to it. And this is why I said I think I've gotten pretty good at this. It's not that, like, if you ask me, Regina, would you rather have a bad back or a good back? I'd pick a good back every day. But I don't have a good back right now. I have a bad back, and that doesn't change a thing. You know, like, I'm still in love with life.
Your happiness is
unchanged. I'm happy. It's unchanged. Right. You know, so that's really what we're talking about. Yeah. Okay. Crap is going to happen till the day you die. If you don't believe me, ask the people in Houston. They can vouch for that right now. Stuff happens. Yeah. All right. So what I'm going to start doing now is I have been reading to you all from The Untethered Soul. And what I'm going to do now is switch to a different book. Some of you may have read it. Some of you may not have. It's In the World But Not of It by Gina Lake. And the reason I selected this book is because Gina does an excellent job at exposing the ego. You know, when we were looking at our first book, which was really The Way of Mastery, really what that book was doing it for us in that early phase was helping us accept that we create our own experience, right? If I'm going to sit here and hate, I don't want to pick Ken. I always pick on Ken. I'll pick Laura. You don't mind?
Nah.
Okay, if I'm going to sit here and hate Ken because he's wearing a brewing shirt, and I don't know, for whatever reason, I don't like, maybe I used to be an alcoholic or something. I don't like brewing shirts. If I'm going to sit here and hate Ken and then keep hating Ken, I find another reason. And then keep hating Ken, I find another reason. Who's creating my experience of hating Ken?
You.
Me. And see, we have to learn that, because we tend to think that Ken's creating it. He's the one doing all the annoying things, right? But that's not true. I'm creating it. I'm creating my experience of hating Ken. So that's the first book we went through, The Way of Mastery, showing us that we are the creator of our experience. The second book we went through, The Untethered Soul, was showing us that not only did we create our experience, but we repressed them. We created experience, we judged against the experience we created, and we repress it. And what we need to learn in order to be free is we need to be open and to allow these experiences to move through us. That's what that whole book was about. Now, we're going to do something else. We're going to start looking at the ego underneath a magnifying glass so that we can try and see more and more of these ego tricks that we're falling for every day that we have not yet become aware of. So that's what our third book is all about, In the World But Not of It, by Gina Lake. So today
I'm going to be one of our retreat leaders.
Who is going to be one of our retreat leaders? And if you want to go, you better register today, because we think we have 3 or 4 beds left for that particular retreat. Yeah. So let's see. Actually, you know, who knows? Maybe registration will slow down and they'll still be there a week from now. But I expect that retreat to be completely full very, very soon. So I'm going to start reading from chapter 1. It's called The Clouds. And by the way, in Gina's experience, these books are channeled by Jesus, not written by Gina. That's how she experiences it. I want to see where I want to start reading, because some of this stuff you guys already know. So here we go. People cling to their thoughts as if for dear life. And of course, we saw this theme in the untethered soul as well, right? We saw that our identification is with our thoughts, and so we cling to our thoughts. In fact, that's how he defined clinging. He defined clinging as clinging to our ideas. You guys remember that? It was one of the last chapters we read. So we're starting right where we left off. People cling to their thoughts as if for dear life, and rightfully so, because without them, there would be no one with a life story, no past, no future, not even a name. Without your thoughts about yourself, you would be no one, nothing. You would be just this, just Christ consciousness, just what is looking out of your eyes and experiencing life. And that's what you actually are. You are what is experiencing life right here and now without any mental commentary. As you progress spiritually, the thoughts in the thought stream become less compelling, less interesting, less true, and less yours. You come to see that you aren't actually responsible for those thoughts. And I don't know if you all remember, but several months ago we read The Code. And do you remember when we read The Code, that the code explained that the thoughts come into our mind from our oneness, right? The thoughts appear. You are not responsible. You are not personally responsible for the thoughts that come into your mind. What you have is a choice as to whether you're going to give them attention or not, but you are not responsible for the fact that they show up, right? And that's what he is saying here as well. You come to see that you aren't actually responsible for those thoughts. This evolution in one's relationship to thoughts makes detaching from them eventually possible. As thoughts are seen to be less personal, they're easier to let go of or leave alone. They can come and go in the background without affecting you because you understand they are simply the programming common to all humans and not uniquely yours. Right? So again, we've already looked at this, but it's been many, many months since we looked at this, so it's probably really, really good to review it. The thoughts that come into my mind are not mine. And so if you really think about that for a moment, think about how crazy it is then to believe the thoughts that come into your mind to the point that you suffer because of them. Right? They're not even yours. They're just appearances that are appearing, right? They have nothing to do with you in spite of their I language, right? In spite of their I'm stupid, I'm busy, I'm irresponsible, I'm lazy, I'm dumb, I'm, you know, fat, I'm ugly, I'm whatever. In spite of their I language, they have nothing to do with you. They're just thoughts that show up in the human mind. He says that you are not the thinker of thoughts. And I remember telling you guys this a lot when we were first starting out. You don't think thoughts, you cast attention. You remember me saying that? Right? He says you are not the thinker of thoughts. You are the experiencer of thoughts. And of course, you'll experience them to the degree that you cast attention. Right? Right? You are not the thinker of thoughts. You are the experiencer of thoughts. He says, you will come to see that you are the spacious, silent presence in which thoughts, feelings, desires, sense impressions, intuitions, knowing insights, inspiration, and motivations come and go. You are the ground of being out of which everything you experience arises. You are that which is eternal and untouched by the coming and going of thoughts, feelings, desires, sense impressions, and the whole world of form. going from attachment to and belief in thoughts to non-attachment and non-belief is generally a lengthy process. And that's the process we're actually in here in the Gentle Healing Group. This spiritual process can take years, decades, or lifetimes, depending on one's level of spiritual development and other factors, like your desire to be free, right? Those who seem to attain enlightenment overnight have laid the groundwork for that over many lifetimes of spiritual practice and encountering spiritual teachings. Thoughts don't give up their hold easily. The ego, which is behind the thought stream, has a firm grip on humanity. And the ego and the thoughts and feelings it generates don't suddenly disappear overnight. And sometimes people get discouraged when they hear that kind of thing. But if you're discouraged by hearing that, that's just because you're listening with the wrong mind. If you listen with the right mind, it actually motivates. It motivates you to want to try more, work harder, give more attention to letting go of the ego. What this does is this basically says it's not going to happen if you don't put effort into it. And if you hear that with the right mind, that encourages you to put effort into it. You want to stop being lazy. Not that you're lazy physically. You might be very, very busy. But I mean lazy spiritually, right? You want to stop. You want to stop being lazy and start putting more effort into the spiritual path when you hear this with the right mind. The illusion spun by thoughts, what Hindus call Maya, must be seen through again and again in each moment until eventually your thoughts give way enough to reveal what is true and real, your divine nature. Once there is some space between thoughts and some capacity to witness thought, the illusion begins to break down and your divine nature begins to shine through. Buddhists often liken true nature or Christ consciousness to a clear, cloudless sky, and thoughts, which create Maya, I think is the right pronunciation. Is that true? Does anybody know? Which create Maya and the false self as clouds in the sky. And NTI Luke does the same thing. It likens our thoughts to clouds, and the blue sky would be a thoughtless mind. The clouds or thoughts are forever changing, forever coming and going. Thoughts never stay the same for long. Although certain thoughts arise repeatedly, no one thought lasts more than a few seconds unless it's given attention. Like clouds, thoughts are flimsy and unsubstantial, constantly morphing into something else, and have a limited lifespan. And this is something we also saw in The Untethered Soul. Remember he talked about how everything was just passing through awareness, but if you cast attention on something, it slows down, and then it can even stop right in front of you, and it can become an important part of your experience. But the reason it became an important part of your experience is because you slowed it down. It's like your attention is like a gravity that grabs a hold of that thought and pulls it in, when if you haven't given it attention, it would have just come and gone. He says, thoughts in general, especially dark ones, can so capture your attention and create a convincing story and emotional experience that you lose touch with the whole truth about a situation. Let's see. And then I'm kind of skipping around a little bit because of time. So what he's talking about next is that there are methods of reversing this process of grabbing a hold of these thoughts and bringing them into your perception, where they become such an important part of your experience that your experience is entirely distorted. And You know, you all may well be aware of this, but I just want to say an individual's experience of something or someone can be highly distorted, and yet you can believe you're totally right about it. You know, so what we're talking about here is how to reverse this process of being highly distorted because we've given our attention to certain thoughts. And he says, the means are spiritual practices. This is the way that you reverse this process. And the examples of spiritual practices that he lists are meditation, contemplation, prayer, and inquiry. And so, you know, I think that we probably cover at least three of these four in our gentle healing homework. Maybe the prayer hasn't been as emphasized. But if you've looked at lesson 221 today, you know that we are stepping into a period in the course, and this is going to be a very long period in the course, not a short one, where we are literally being asked to contemplate and then meditate every day. And this isn't Regina giving the homework. You know, Regina's been giving this homework for some time. This is the course now giving the homework. The course is asking us to contemplate the lesson and let that lead us directly into meditation. And then, of course, we know that inquiry is a very, very important part of breaking up the ego, right? Breaking up our belief or breaking up our attention on thoughts. Now, the prayer component, we'll see if Gina's book emphasizes the prayer component more, and if so, how. I'll just tell you from my own experience, the prayer component has been used many, many times in my past to increase my desire for awakening. You know, I have a devotional heart, and so when I slip into prayer, like let's say I don't feel like contemplating or I don't feel like meditating, what I will do then is go to prayer. And if I, when I go to prayer, while I'm in the prayer, I shift from resistance into now wanting to contemplate or now wanting to meditate. So I've always used prayer as a means to increase my desire. He says, as a result of these practices and with continuing with these practices, the clouds transform from thick, dark, and sometimes ominous clouds to thin, white, and lovely clouds, with blue sky showing through on most days. Eventually, what remains in the thought stream are mostly thoughts that coexist harmoniously within the sky without blocking it. Those thoughts are allowed to come and go, to move through the sky naturally. And yet, an even more brilliant sky is possible once the puffy white clouds also disappear, since the positive and neutral thoughts are not needed either. Most of those are simply commentary about what you already know and what's already happening. And I think I've expressed this before, that I perceive the vast majority of my thoughts now as benign. They're things like, okay, I'm walking over to the refrigerator. Okay, I'm going to get the milk now. All right, I'm pouring the milk. And it's just like, it's just chatter. But it's not the type of chatter I used to experience, which would have been while I was getting the milk, I was thinking about how much I hated Ken, right? So there's a big difference. But what he's really saying here is that big difference is still not, of course, all the way. That all the way is going to be more like a cloudless sky. But you'll start experiencing a lot of joy and a lot of harmony when your thoughts are these more benign types of thoughts. So most of those are simply commentary about what you already know and what's already happening. To function, you don't even need those thoughts. That's absolutely true. You can grab the milk without your mind telling you that you're grabbing the milk. It just likes to talk. Christ consciousness moves beautifully in life without thoughts in the thought stream. If you need to think to perform some task, you think. But otherwise, thoughts are not required. And this is what I heard Adyashanti say the other day. He said, when he wants to think, he can. But his mind doesn't think all the time. Right? It's like the thinking becomes a tool. And when you want access to the tool, you have it. But if you're not using the tool now, it lays aside silently. At every stage of the spiritual journey, he says, some amount of ego remains. In the beginning, the ego is thicker and holds more sway. It isn't always recognized and is still often identified with. As the journey progresses and there's more awareness of the ego, it becomes thinner, more transparent, less substantial, and less powerful, but it is still there. The ego continues to thin out until there's only the barest amount, only enough to function. The ego is generally the thinnest. That's a great diet, don't you think? He's using the word thin, so it made me think of diet. The ego is generally the thinnest when people are by themselves, without guests. The ego is generally the thinnest when people are by themselves, but listen to this, and most apparent when they're interacting with others. That's when the thoughts inevitably roll in. So, again, we're still in the introduction of this book, which is why it seems pretty light. Like I said, it's going to get into pointing out a whole lot of ego tricks, which is why I picked it. But I think it just pointed out the first ego trick, even though it's still in the introduction. And I want to point this out, that our ego will strengthen when we're around others. And that's an important thing to be aware of. What you want to do when you get into social situations, when you're around other people, is you want to learn to be quiet more. Unless you're Danielle, then you got to learn to talk. She's over there teasing me, like, oh, see? No. You want to learn to be quiet more. You want to learn to shut up more. Because the more you talk, the more your ego is going to jump in there. And I'm sure you guys have probably all experienced this. I'm sure you know that when you're like at home by yourself, you know, kind of inward tuned, you know, you can learn to stay away from your ego. But then you get in a social situation and it doesn't matter what people are talking about. Pretty soon you're right back again. You're right back in your ego. So this is one of our challenges, is to learn to be around people without slipping back into our egos. And it's something that I find very challenging. When I sit down and relax with my closest friends, I can feel that ego returning, right? So it's one of my current remaining challenges. So pay attention to yourself when you're with people. Can you be with people and yet keep that ego in the background? You know, when political conversations start showing up, when we start talking about the news, what's happening in the world, when we start talking about how much money we do or do not have, what other things do we talk about that bring up the ego? I don't know. Everybody's here not talking.
Ourself.
We talk about ourself, yeah. So pay attention to that when you're around people. Family. Yeah, family's a big one for a lot of people, right? They get totally triggered when they're around their family. So this is a great place for us to start paying attention. Let's make it a goal to learn to be with people without being with our ego, without holding hands with it all the way.
One of the greatest temptations when you're around people is gossip.
Gossip. Oh, that's
about who is not there.
About who is not there. Yeah, there's a real good example. That's an excellent example. And I bet if we were all in a room, you know, a physical room together, and I had a flip chart, and I said, let's start flip charting how our ego comes back when we're with people. Once a few people started throwing out ideas like, you know, your gossip, and I said the news and other stuff, I bet we could end up with quite a healthy list. And that might even be worthwhile on your own. You know, because again, one way that we see the ego is by seeing it. So start writing down ways that you are aware. You don't have to share it with anybody. Write down ways that you are aware that your ego comes back when you're with other people. Bring that into your awareness. And as you bring that into your awareness, then the next time you're with people, you can learn to shut up when that starts arising, right? Just don't go there. And this doesn't mean that you're not going to talk to people, but when you talk to people, you want to make sure you're not talking from your ego, right? You just want to do that. So when your ego's arising, that's when you want to keep quiet. Because if you talk from your ego, you're going to feed your ego. So again, the ego is generally the thinnest when people are by themselves and most apparent when they're interacting with others. Then the thoughts inevitably roll in. If those thoughts are identified with a little, they become puffy white clouds and some presence is lost. If they are identified with a lot, they become thicker and possibly gray as they turn into stories that people tell, which make them unhappy. Then the ego is back in charge. And I love how he's pointing out, you know your ego's back in charge when you're no longer happy. Think about that. So, you know, again, we're talking about the news. I'm getting all worked up about what, you know, somebody said on the news, whether it's the president or the news commentator or whatever. When I'm getting all worked up about what somebody said on the news, that means I just stepped back into ego. I can tell by how I feel, right? So pay attention to how you feel. If the stories are identified with intensely enough, they create feelings and cover over the blue sky completely, at least for a time. Most people are identified with their thought streams most of the time, with only brief moments of clear seeing and freedom from their thoughts. For others, the opposite is true. They live in blue sky consciousness and move into some degree of identification with thought briefly, and then return to blue sky consciousness. One sounds like the less spiritually mature, the other sounds like the more spiritually mature. Those who've realized that they are the blue sky never lose touch with blue sky consciousness, right? Never lose touch. So you can kind of see the difference. You can see the progression there. You start off mostly identified with your thoughts, then eventually only occasionally identified with your thoughts, and then realizing your true self, you just never identify with your thoughts. They're there, but you're not identified with them. Even after conditioning has been see-through quite thoroughly, some emotional residue usually remains, which can be reactivated under the right circumstances. When conditioning does get triggered, that's when more about it can be discovered and healed, if you're willing to question and investigate those thoughts and feelings. How this is done will be explained more thoroughly later. So even as you move into the more mature spiritual person, spiritual student, whatever we want to call ourselves, where you have mostly blue sky, what he is saying is there can be some, I call it dormant emotion, that isn't triggered on a daily basis, and you might even think that it's gone, that it's dead, until something happens, something very extreme, something very unexpected happens, and it triggers it. And what he's really doing is he's saying our attitude towards that is that this is an opportunity to get to know this and let this go. So we don't want to see it as we failed, we fell backwards, whatever. You know, maybe I haven't seen, you know, hatred in 6 years, and then somebody hurts my daughter, and that hatred arises, right? It took that to trigger it because it was so dormant. When that gets triggered, this is my opportunity to investigate into that and complete the letting go of it, right? Complete the letting go of it. So he's saying that there can be a lot of peace, and then things can begin to arise again. And we kind of saw this in the Bible, because remember, Jesus went into his 40 days and 40 nights in the desert. There was a lot of peace, and then it came time for the Garden of Gethsemane scene, and all that dormant stuff came up again, right? Let's see, we're almost done here, which is good because we're almost out of time. He says, the thought stream is full of thoughts, clouds generated by the ego to serve the ego. The ego is a cloud-producing machine designed to obscure reality, including your divine nature, and create a virtual reality, one that serves the ego's needs and drives. The thought stream is nearly always the voice of the ego. The voice in your head is nearly always the voice of the ego. And that's all the further I plan to read today. I was just getting us through that introduction. We'll start looking at more specific stuff later. But again, what this book is going to go into is really, really looking at the ego, really, really looking at the ego's tricks, and this is a great opportunity for us. Since there was really only one trick brought up this time, we can kind of focus our attention this week if we have the opportunity to be around people. Start noticing your ego when you're with others, even if you're just in conversation with your spouse, and start learning to step away from your ego when you're with others, all right? It's a great, great opportunity to practice. So we'll go into our homework. We're going to be doing workbook lessons 222 to 228. And, of course, we'll practice daily awareness, watching awareness, loving consciousness, or abandon release method of meditation. The one change that's happening now that we're in part two of the course is we are increasing our meditation. It's now going to be a 20 to 40 minutes a day. So 20 to 40 minutes a day. So that's an increase on what we've been doing. And, of course, we're going to continue practicing that loving all method. And then assignment B, it's three videos, so it looks like a lot, but each of these videos are very, very short. I think they're like 8 minutes or 12 minutes each, something like that. So assignment B is that we're going to watch three videos. We're going to watch a video called Choose Again, Six Steps, a video called Nosara Video Part 1, and Nosara Video Part 2. And it will benefit you if you watch the videos in the order listed. These are videos about the Choose Again inquiry process. So it's just another option. In fact, somebody told me recently that root cause inquiry and Byron Katie inquiry just isn't working for them. It doesn't click yet. So Choose Again is a third option. Maybe this one will work. So that's all we're doing is learning a third method of inquiry. And so that's assignment B, the Choose Again Six Steps video, the Nosara video part one, the Nosara video part two. And then I'll talk more about Choose Again next week. And that's it. That's it for tonight. So thank you very much. Enjoy your course lessons that are coming up. They're very different from the type that we were doing before. They're shorter with more meditation time. So have a good time. Bye.